Hello, and welcome to Field Fisher's Data and Privacy Matters podcast. Today, we're going to give you a roundup of the major legal updates from February 2024. I'm Sophia, a solicitor at Field Fisher, and I'm here with Camille and Charlie, and we're all based in Field Fisher's London Data and Privacy team.
Hi there, I'm Camille, a director in the Field Fisher Data and Privacy team.
And hi, I'm Charlie, an associate in the Field Fisher Data and Privacy team.
So even with February being a shorter month, the world of data and privacy has continued to hit the headlines and provide us with a long list of material to cram into this podcast. Please note that this podcast will be released with an accompanying webpage that will provide a hyperlink to sources for each item covered to allow you to take a deeper dive. Firstly, we're going to turn our attention to the Digital Services Act.
Yes, and you may have seen that the second phase of the EU Digital Services Act, or the DSA, came into force on the 17th of February for all providers of online intermediary services, or ISPs. Looking at the extensive description provided on the EU Commission's website, the DSA covers marketplaces, social networks, content sharing platforms, app stores, and online travel and accommodation platforms. This is broad, and many organisations will be caught. The main aim of the DSA is to protect online users against illegal content and provide them with actionable rights. The DSA also updates and harmonises the position on liability for digital service providers. The DSA is a regulation and therefore has direct effect across all EU member states, and there will also be national laws to deal with certain aspects, including supervision and enforcement.
I've seen headlines already on the DSA for some of the bigger tech companies, so I thought this was already in force.
That's a great spot, Sophia. The DSA has a sliding scale of obligations depending on what category of ISP you fall into. Think of it like a layer of an onion. The largest group we expect to be caught is intermediary services. And the next layer would be hosting services. And the next was online platforms. And then finally, we would have what we call very large online platforms known as VLOPs and very large online search engines known as VLOSEs. So looking at your question, Sophia, VLOPs and VLOSEs, who are subject to the most stringent obligations under the DSA, were designated by the EU Commission last year, and they had to comply by the 25th of August 2023. Therefore, on the 17th of February this month, the DSA was generally applicable to all other services. This means that those platforms or intermediaries that are now within scope are subject to obligations ranging from designating points of contact, putting in place measures to address illegal content or prohibitions on certain targeted advertising, being transparent about their content moderation and decisions taken in respect of such content.
I see, thank you. And did I see TikTok in the headlines in connection with the DSA?
Yeah, that's right. So the European Commission has announced they have launched formal proceedings into TikTok, who are a VLOP, and their compliance with the DSA, particularly focused on protecting underage users.
Thanks, Charlie. With this being an EU act, is it only EU organisations that are caught?
No. As with other EU regulations, including the GDPR, the DSA has extraterritorial effect. So the DSA itself states that it will apply to intermediary services offered to recipients of the service that have their place of establishment or are located in the Union, irrespective of where the providers of those intermediary services have their place of establishment. So therefore, if you are operating in the EU, you are likely to be caught within the scope. So for those who haven't started to consider the DSA or who have considered it but not yet completed their compliance effort, it is key to engage with this now. For more information about the Digital Services Act, do check out the Field Fisher blogs and more detailed webinars on this topic.
Thank you for that, Charlie. So as you mentioned, the DSA imposes some regulations regarding transparency over content moderation, which leads me on to the fact that the ICO has issued guidance on content moderation on the 16th of February.
Oh, that's interesting. What does it cover?
So it sets out how to comply with key UK data protection legal obligations, as well as good practice recommendations in the content moderation context regarding, for example, identifying an appropriate lawful basis for the content moderation, as well as an Article 9 condition for any special category data. It also explores when you might be processing criminal offences data during your content moderation, and if so, how to comply with Article 10 UK GDPR. It sets out when you will need to carry out a data protection impact assessment, known as a DPIA, before starting your content moderation, and what risks need to be considered in a content moderation DPIA. And it also looks at how to use any automated decision-making involved in content moderation in a compliant way. The guidance applies to both controllers and processors that carry out content moderation or who provide content moderation products and services.
Well, it sounds like a lot is covered, but would I be right that there are a few areas that are excluded?
Yes, that's right. The guidance sets out a few issues it does not cover, such as carrying out user profiling in content moderation and obligations to report child sexual exploitation and abuse content. Further specific guidance is planned for these areas.
I see. Could you give us some key takeaways?
Yes, sure. So they made some interesting comments about when your content moderation involves special category data. For instance, they set out that if the user-generated content you're moderating includes clearly special category information about users, such as posts where identifiable users are directly expressing their political views, for example, then you are processing special category information regardless of whether you intend to. Now, I have heard some companies say that in some circumstances, they don't know in advance whether the data and scope of their content moderation activities will contain special category data, that they don't intend to process it, and therefore they conclude that they don't need an Article 9 condition. So this guidance gives some food for thought, and some may need to review their approach in view of this new guidance. Now, the guidance also sets out mandatory triggers for a DPIA to be carried out under UK data protection law, which may be involved in content moderation, such as, for instance, where the moderation will involve solely automated processing that has a legal or similarly significant effect on the user, children's personal data, of course, and of course also new technologies or the novel application of existing technologies, including AI. The ICO also sets out that it would be good practice to carry out a DPIA for content moderation activities, even if you assess your processing does not meet the mandatory trigger and it's not likely to result in high risk.
It sounds like there's plenty to consider. And you touched on AI there, Camille, a topic which I know Sophia has been very much across. Sophia, what's new this month in the world of AI?
Well, the European Commission announced the establishment of the European AI Office to support the EU's approach to AI. We did touch on this briefly in our last podcast, but it now has an official page on the European Commission website, which gives further detail on its key tasks. This AI office will sit within the European Commission and will take on a wide span of tasks, including supporting the implementation of the AI Act, strengthening the development and use of trustworthy AI, and advancing international cooperation. The AI office will also oversee the AI Pact, which is a voluntary political initiative aimed at encouraging and supporting businesses in planning ahead to ensure that they're compliant with the AI Act before it comes into force.
Now, the AI office has been connected with some criticism of the AI Act. What's this all about?
So there have been comments that the final text of the AI Act is likely to cause issues because where it sets out the role of the European Commission, it refers interchangeably between the European Commission as a whole and the AI office. The body's investigatory and enforcement powers are not always clear. So don't forget, the AI office sits within the European Commission. It's not an EU agency. So it could be difficult to ascertain which entity is in charge and how that relationship is quite going to work.
So what stage are we at with the AI Act now?
The EU Parliament's draft agenda has scheduled the plenary vote for the 13th of March, which is 1 month earlier than what was initially reported. And if the text is adopted at that meeting, then the AI Act could be published shortly afterwards and it could enter into force as early as April or May.
So this is all, of course, very EU-focused, though it will, of course, impact some UK businesses and users as well. What about the UK AI regulation for those operating in the UK?
The UK government this month published its response to the public consultation on its proposals in its AI white paper. So the government emphasised their firmly pro-innovative and strong pro-safety approach.
And how has the government's position changed since their white paper of last year?
Although the white paper took a sector-specific, non-statutory regulatory approach, the government notes in the response that the challenges posed by AI technologies will ultimately require legislative action in every country once understanding of the risk has matured. So this suggests that the government is anticipating some sort of binding measure in the future, but the response does note that introducing such measures too soon would risk them becoming out of date really quickly or stifling innovation. And alongside this response, the government has published initial guidance for regulators on implementing the UK's AI regulatory principles. And whilst this isn't intended to be prescriptive, it does set out considerations when developing tools and guidance, and it's the first in a three-phase series of guidance. And last but not least, it was also announced that over £100 million has been dedicated to help realise new AI innovations and support regulators' technical capabilities.
AI was also a key focus of the IAPP this month and was a significant part of John Edwards, the Information Commissioner's keynote speech. One of the points he mentioned, and you may have seen this already, is the ICO's second generative AI consultation, which opened towards the end of the month. This consultation is part of a wider series that the ICO is carrying out on generative AI. The focus of this second consultation is on how the data protection principle of purpose limitation should be applied at the different stages in the generative AI lifecycle. In the consultation, the ICO has sort of set out its policy position on the topic and is calling for any input from either email or on a survey form with views. John Edwards' speech also noted some of the other areas that the ICO is focusing on. This includes children's privacy and advertising technology work, providing an update on the cookie banner, outreach work, and an AI tool that the ICO is developing, which is covered by our colleagues in the January podcast. He also mentioned the ICO's focus on biometrics. And Sophia, you've taken a look at the decision that he was referred to, haven't you?
I did. On 23rd of February, the ICO issued an enforcement notice to public service provider Serco Leisure, Serco Jersey, and seven associated community leisure trusts, ordering them to stop using biometric data to track their employees within the next 3 months and to destroy the collected data. Serco had required their employees to be scanned using facial recognition technology and fingerprint scanning to clock in and out of work, and it was presented as a requirement for payment. The ICO had said Serco had unlawfully processed the employees' biometric data and had failed to show why such processing was necessary or proportionate when there are less intrusive means available. John Edwards had highlighted that the ICO felt that Serco hadn't fully considered the risks before using biometric technology and that employees weren't offered a clear way to opt out. And with a workplace power imbalance, they were unlikely to be able to object. The fact that the ICO issued an enforcement notice rather than a fine, which might have been expected, does show that the ICO will use the most relevant tool available to it when taking action. And the ICO has simultaneously published new guidance to outline how organisations can use biometric recognition in compliance with data protection law. And there's also ICO guidance available on monitoring employees. Moving on to a different topic. Camille, you've been looking at the European Data Protection Board's opinion on the one-stop shop, haven't you?
Yes, thanks, Sophia. I have indeed. And this follows fairly hot on the heels of the EDPB's case digest on the one-stop shop, which was covered in our January podcast. By way of reminder, and for new listeners, the digest set out how EU data protection authorities have interpreted and applied the one-stop shop. Now, for anyone unfamiliar with the one-stop shop mechanism, essentially where a company carries out cross-border processing across the European Economic Area, the EEA, the GDPR allows the supervisory authority of that company's main establishment in the EEA to act as its lead authority. The idea being to have a more streamlined regulation process. However, we have seen the concept of one-stop shop tested a number of times by supervisory authorities, particularly with many of the big tech companies positioning the Irish DPC as their lead authority.
So what does the new EDPB opinion say on the one-stop shop?
Well, it follows a request from the French regulator, the CNIL, who asked the EDPB to issue an opinion on the criteria for establishing a lead authority, and in particular regarding the rules for determining a controller's main establishment in the EEA. Now, Article 4 GDPR sets out that the main establishment of a controller will be its place of central administration in the EEA, unless there is an EEA establishment that makes decisions on the purposes and means of the processing and has the power to implement such decisions, which then would be the main establishment. However, in the opinion, the EDPB conclude that in their view, a controller's place of central administration in the EEA can only be considered as the controller's main establishment if it also takes the decisions on the purposes and means of processing personal data and if it has the power to have such decisions implemented. So in other words, under the EDPB's opinion, if you have a place of central administration in the EEA, but it does not make those decisions or have the required implementation power, then you do not have a main establishment and cannot rely on the one-stop shop.
And did the opinion address what happens where the decisions on processing are actually taken outside of the EEA?
Yes. The opinion set out that the one-stop shop can only apply if the relevant controller has evidence that one of the establishments of the controller in the EEA takes the relevant decisions on the processing and has the required implementation power. So for companies and groups headquartered outside the EEA, but who nevertheless position themselves as having an EEA main establishment, they may now want to look again at how they determined the identity of their main establishment and ensure they have evidence to back up that the EEA establishment does indeed make the decisions regarding personal data processing in the EEA and have the required implementation power.
Thanks, Camille. So speaking of the EDPB, they have also been considering guidance on Meta's pay or okay model. As you may recall, last year, Meta announced its decision to offer what has been termed a pay or okay model on its Facebook and Instagram platforms in the EU. And this means that users of those services can either pay an annual fee or they can agree to receive personalised adverts. According to the latest plenary meeting agenda, a topic for the EDPB meeting was the request for a mandate on guidance for consent or pay.
So has there been an update or a suggestion on when we would see any guidance?
There hasn't yet. We also have seen a joint letter from different civil organisations, which has been shared by the NOYB. And this letter calls on the EDPB and all DPAs to firmly oppose Meta's pay or okay model. Also of note, the Dusseldorf High Regional Court has partially upheld an injunction that prohibited Meta from using its current language on its pay or consent order buttons. So the court in this matter emphasised that companies are legally required to label order buttons with language that clearly states there'll be an order with an obligation to pay. Meta's subscribe button, which would be used by customers signing up for the paid service, fell short of this requirement. So the Consumer Centre had alleged that this was a violation of consumer protection law in Dusseldorf.
Thanks, Charlie. So on another topic, the Spanish and Dutch regulators both issued new cookie guidance in February. The new Spanish guidance from the AEPD sets out that they consider that audience measurement cookies that are used strictly to collect traffic or performance statistics may be exempt from consent requirements under the local e-privacy rules in certain situations. Now, the new Dutch guidance is broader, covers the nature of cookies, as well as a requirement for a first layer reject all option. Nothing too new there. The Dutch regulator also considers that purposes should ideally appear on the first layer of a consent prompt. So something to bear in mind for companies who are revisiting their cookie compliance across the EEA. Now, have there been any notable fines in February, Sophia?
Yes, I've just got two to mention this month, Camille. So firstly, the Italian Garante has fined Enel Energia, who are Italy's largest electricity and gas utility, €79 million after accusing the company of mishandling customer personal data for telemarketing. The Garante said a lack of security for customer databases led to abusive touts accessing customer data and carrying out unlawful telemarketing. And the Garante also claimed that Enel had acquired personal data on over 900 users from four companies which were outside its sales network. It's worth noting that this is the highest fine ever imposed by the Garante, and Enel are planning to appeal. And secondly, a little bit closer to home, the ICO fined the Ministry of Defence £350,000 after they disclosed 265 unique email addresses over multiple instances when the emails were included in the To field rather than the BCC field. And this was, of course, a breach of the integrity and confidentiality principle under Article 5.1f of the UK GDPR. They were issued a fine rather than an enforcement notice because of the gravity of this situation. There was a high degree of potential harm because it concerned evacuations from Afghanistan, and the Ministry of Defence ought to have been aware of this problem. And don't forget, the ICO has published guidance on sending bulk communications by email and using alternatives to BCC.
Thanks, Sophia. And remind us to all to be very careful before pressing send on our emails. And that is all we have time for this month. So thank you for joining us for this monthly roundup of the key legal updates on the Field Fisher Data and Privacy Matters podcast. If you have any questions about today's update, of course, don't hesitate to contact any of us. And if you found it useful, do make sure to give us a like or review on your podcast channel of choice. As always, thanks for taking the time to listen. And thanks, Camille and Sophia, for joining.